You're going to have to correct this sentence. It reads, prophetic numbers should be interpreted literally when consistent, not inconsistent. Mark out the IN. I was typing by ear, not by... It's my first draft of this syllabus, so it'll be corrected next time around. Prophetic numbers should be interpreted literally when consistent, comma, otherwise as definite or indefinite. Prophetic numbers should be interpreted literally when consistent, otherwise as definite or indefinite. Now, here's what I mean by that. That you can't, there is no hard and fast rule for numbers when they're used in prophecy. This is quite complicated. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. But I would point out that example, first of all, of numbers which are sometimes used literally, if not exactly. In prophetic language, numbers that are used literally, if not exactly. By the way, basically what this rule says is there isn't any rule. Right? You understand that? There isn't any rule to follow. What we have here are just some observations. Genesis 7:4, for 7 more days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. I take it that's exact and literal. We can look at Isaiah 7:8 and Daniel 9:2, which we're not going to do. Well, let's look at Daniel 9:2 because it's in the book of Daniel where numbers appear quite heavily. In the first year, I, Daniel, observed in the book the number of the years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet for the completion of the desolation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. Now here it is not used exactly, but it is used literally and almost exactly. And we study this in the Daniel class. We're not going to study it here. That what happened is that Jeremiah had prophesied that the Jews would be in the fix they were in for 70 years. And again, that's a round number. And 68 years, as a matter of fact, if you study it, 68 years had passed, and Babylon had fallen, and Daniel, citing Jeremiah, is saying to God, it's about time, isn't it? Now, Daniel did not understand to be exactly 70 years, because only 68 and a half years had passed, but that was close enough. He understood 70 was general, but note this, it is a literal number. It means, but it's not precise, it doesn't mean 70 years to the day. Numbers, by the way, numbers in the ancient world were less precise than they are now, and we don't use numbers precisely in our common everyday language, do we? No. A dozen or so, three or four, a few. We use numbers quite imprecisely. Well, but at least it was a literal use of the word, if not not precisely 70 years. Okay, so that's an example of numbers used literally, if not exactly. The next example we have, or next thing we point out, is it is often thought that the number 7 stands symbolically for perfection or completeness, often an indefinite number standing for the whole. Now, let me say this about numbers. The ancients were, not just the Jews, but the ancient people in general were enamored of numbers. For instance, the use of mathematics is a very ancient science. Do you realize that the ancient Sumerians, who lived before 2000 BC, had a math that was comparable to our calculus? And, as a matter of fact, you know this, don't you, that our numbers, a part of our numbering system goes back to the ancient Sumerian, ancient Old Babylonian system, not all of it. Part of it is the Roman system, or the Phoenician system, but the old Sumerian system was based on the number 6. The Roman system was based on number 10. That's why, for instance, we have 12 hours in the day, and our circle is divided into 360 degrees divisible by 6, and an hour is 60 minutes. It's like an odd number. And 24 hours in a day, number not divisible by 10, but divisible by 6. And our math is based on, our basic math part of it is based on number 6. And it goes all the way back to that period. And The ancients, we're going to talk, we've talked about Kabbalism, or we haven't named it that. We will when we get the survey of history, but time permits. But the we've already seen that the letters in most languages did double duty as numbers. But the ancients really liked to play games with numbers. And some of our modern math comes from, came from the Greeks, and originally it came from game playing. For instance, the Thales and look at the mental block. The Pythagorean mathematics, Pythagorean principles, is sound mathematics, but Pythagoras himself was something of a mystic. That is, he drew all kinds of transcendental, religious, mystical implications of numbers. And so, what I'm saying is this, the ancients were enamored of numbers, and numbers, and because their language was more figurative than ours anyway, for not a lot of other reasons, let me simply summarize it by saying that, the ancients were very comfortable, like they liked to do it, they liked to treat numbers symbolically. Now, we don't do that. It's very foreign to our thinking to treat numbers symbolically. But they did. And it's got to be quite a... We'll see this. We're going to get into allegorism, Kabbalism. But anyway, we'll just leave it at that for the sake of sort of getting the big picture. And the number seven, what I'm saying is that we see this kind of thing in the Bible. All that that means, it doesn't mean that God likes to dabble, likes to play games with numbers. All it means is that God always speaks to men in their own literary context. And he spoke to a world where numbers were often used that way. Now, number seven, Joshua 6, 13 through 15. By the way, let me ask you this. Why might the number seven take on a... not only take on a... in a world where numbers take on symbolic significance, why would the number seven sometimes take on or be symbolic for perfection or completeness? Yeah, the creation. 7 days, 6 days God rested, then the seventh day, or 6 days God created man, created the world and man, seventh day he rested, then he started again. It's complete. Yes?
When did this completion deal, when did they first start?
Well, we don't really know. But it was in their culture. So God, like I say, God speaks to them in the culture. But you can't date it.
There's nothing in the Bible that says
that. No, you just sort of find it reflected. It's sort of used. It's not commanded or explained. Simply used. But all kinds of things are used that people were doing.
You know, prayer. I think back to the Martinez, one book that we had, this guy felt that Abraham had asked God six times.
Yeah, I doubt that. Yes.
How long have we been establishing a 7-day calendar? Rome did a 2-day calendar.
Well, we say this in early church history in the world of the Bible, but the we in the West use the Jewish calendar because Jesus rose on the first day of the week. The church used the early church. The church was Jewish and used the Jewish calendar, the 7-day week. The Romans didn't have a 7-day week. They had a month that was roughly divided into 3 10-day periods, the Ides, the Nones, and the Calends, roughly 10 days each. But with Constantine, in other words, because of the influence of the church, in other words, the Jewish church continued to use the Jewish calendar, and the Gentiles came in, they adopted it. So you had in the second, third centuries, and in the fourth century, you had the predominantly Christian Roman world, nominally Christian, who were using two calendars, and most of them were still using the Jewish 7-day calendar because of the influence of the church, and so Rome just went the way of the church. That's why we do it.
What period did the 10-day
calendar be? The 10-day calendar was way back before the time of Christ. It was back to the founding of Rome. I don't know. I don't know if it is known. Back probably the 5th century B.C. Do you understand that? There's the influence of the church. The church adopted the Jewish calendar. Under the influence of the church, the Roman West adopted the Jewish calendar, and as far as the 7-day week and the 7-day week, and that's about it. Don't change they made significant change. Joshua 6, 13 through 15. And seven priests carrying seven trumpets of ram's horns blew the trumpets, and they went around the city how many times? Well, once a day for 6 days. On the seventh day, they marched around the city seven times. On the seventh time, the seven priests blew the seven trumpets.
Why seven? Well, they only had seven horn players in the whole outfit. And they only had a week to do it because they had a trip schedule. I don't know.
Well, isn't it a coincidence? Well, there seems to have been some, there was the operate that way, symbolic connection with the number seven. If you agree with that, and I gave you some other scripture, Leviticus 23:4, Isaiah 30:26, Daniel 3:9. Revelation, let's look at Revelation 1 through 3. We're not going to take time to look at all these, but you might like to. Now, this is chapters 1 through 3. Seven stars, letters to the seven churches in Asia. Now, that's problematic. There were these seven churches in Asia. Of course, you know the order that they appear in the book of Revelation. It starts with Ephesus, chapter 2. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. That's the order they come on the Roman post. Sure, that's not symbolic of the seven ages of the church. That's the order they came on. But I would suggest that maybe there was some symbolic use, because those weren't the only churches in the area. For instance, the church at Colossae near Laodicea. Why was it? Why not eight churches? Let's see. These are perhaps leading churches, but maybe there's some significance to seven, you know, to just picking out seven of them in the order and leaving out the others. The others would be included in it. The message would be just as applicable and apropos to them as to these seven churches. No, that's problematic, as I say. Let's look back at Daniel 3:19. Let's look at one more before we move on. Daniel 3:19. I'd like to finish this whole section today. I don't know if we will or not. Don't want to rush over it too much. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. Now, of course, that's, again, note this is a symbolic use of the word seven, even in this. Of course, he being a Semitic, a pagan, doesn't mean apparently go back to the some kind of Adamic tradition used this. But anyway, of course, they had no way of knowing. They didn't have thermometers. Could measure it seven times. You know, exactly seven times hotter. They didn't throw anybody in while it was still six and a half times as hot. See, how would you measure that? No, you see, what he's saying, what do you think he's meaning? If seven is the number for perfection or completeness, what's he saying? He did seven. My wife's grandfather was an old Kentucky preacher. He grew up in the hills and didn't go to high school until he got out of. So it was late in his late teens, and he went to College of the Bible and Drake and got his master's degree, and he cleaned up his language. That is, he didn't speak at the hillbilly, spoke as a refined gentleman. He was educated, but he really got to preaching, and he slipped back into his the language of his upbringing. And she, grandma, who's dead now, I used to love to hear him preach, because she said one time he was preaching along on Daniel and he just really got heated up himself, and he got to this text and he, you know, forgot his gentlemanly training, his higher education. He said, and he commanded to be het seven times hotter than it was wont to be het. Well, what was he saying? Heat it seven times hotter than it's ever been heated before. Or usually he, what's he saying? Yeah, as hot as it can get. Make it as hot as it can get. Completely hot. I mean, throw out all you've got. I want it as hot as that thing will go. That's how hot I want it. You see that? I think so. And so, that's all he was saying. But see the symbolic use of the word seven? Even with the pagan. Okay. Now listen, does that mean every time the number seven in the Bible, you are to attach figurative or symbolic or even or prophetic significance to it? Absolutely not. That's silly. Sometimes the number happens to be seven. Now the allegorists we're going to see would do just that. Every time they found a number, there was number seven, they would go romping away on it. Doesn't mean that at all.
Larger numbers are often used as adjectives, roughly synonymous for much. I've already talked about this in another connection, have I not? I talked about how ancient the use of language in the ancient Near East, the linguistic context, linguistic history. That is, the number of thousands often was simply an adjective. It wasn't a head count of soldiers or the dead after a battle. Often it just meant many. And we're not going to get into that. We've already talked about that. The number 10 is often used for a small but significant number. The number 10, often used, not always, I mean, every time you find the number of 10, you're free to interpret the tar out of it. The number 10 is often used, not for exactly 10, but for a small, significant number. Now, this is not always in prophetic language. It's like in Nebuchadnezzar's command to heat the furnace, and then there's prophecy. It just shows the use of that number 7. Look at Genesis 31:41. That's the first one we list. These 20 years I've been in your house, I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. Well, Bible scholars generally think that here's an example because of how it's used elsewhere. That this was an expression, not exactly 10 times, probably less than 10. Probably changed them every year, maybe. But a significant number of times. Small, but significant. Let's look at Leviticus 26:26. Again, we're not sure about all these things. We're just doing the best we can. He's talking about the penalties for disobeying God. If you don't obey me, this is what's going to happen to you. I will bring, verse 25, I will also bring upon you a sword which will execute vengeance for the covenant. When you gather together to your cities, I will send pestilence among you if you don't shape up, you don't keep your promise, so that you shall be delivered into enemy hands. When I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven. It will bring back your bread in rationed amounts, so that you will eat and not be satisfied. 10 women will bake your bread in one oven. What does that mean? You're going to be so hard up that your wives are going to have so little to bake that 10 of them can bake it all at the same time in one oven. Now, normally how many would bake in an oven? One at a time. See? You're not going to be making big loaves of bread. You're going to be making dollar-sized pancakes. You're going to be starving. You got that? You're going to be so hungry that the 10 can bake all the bread they've got. One oven, same thing. But note this. Exactly 10. It's not 9, you see. It won't be that. It'll be worse than that. Not as bad as 11. Exactly. No, you see. It's a comparatively small but significant number. There, it's not used exactly. It's used symbolically. A small but significant number. Not 100 women, but not 2 women. You see. And not exactly 10 women. But 10 used for a small but significant number. 1 Samuel 1:8. Rick, I don't mean to spend all this time on this, but... Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, this is the husband of Hannah, of course, and Hannah wants a baby boy. Why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? She says, I'm on Weight Watchers. No. Why aren't you eating? And he says to her, am I not better to you than 10 sons? Again, not exactly 10. She says, she didn't say to him, no, but you're better than 9. Missed it, one son. No, a small but significant number. And we'll leave it at that. Now note this, it is often used for that. Often used. By the way, Revelation 12:3. Let's look at one more. I have something to say about this. Revelation 12:3. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head were 7 diadems. 7 and 10,
By the way, I think it's very silly for dispensationalists in any stripe to really desperately count the number of nations in the European common market, because you know that there were 10 toes on the beast. On the Emmys, they assumed there were 10 toes and 10 horns and 10 horns on the beast, and that's the revived Roman Empire. Therefore, that should be exactly 10 nations in it. First place, they got the wrong. It's not eschatological from our point of view, but my point here is to say, well, it says 10, it means what?
10. I take the Bible for what it says. I believe the Bible. It says 10 is going to be 10. And so it's interesting. When they only had 9, they promised one more would join. When they had 11, they said one's going to get out. Why? It's to be exactly 10 to fulfill prophecies. God always says what he means. Absolute ignorance. Number 10 often is used for a small but significant number. And even if you took that view of prophecy, well, no matter when you put it in history or in time, the fulfillment of the city of 10 horns, I think it's utterly ridiculous to say it says 10, it means 10. If I wrote 10, I would mean 10. But to say when Daniel wrote 10 and when John wrote 10, they had to mean 10 is simply pure, unadulterated, government inspected, certified, 20th century, middle American, middle class stupidity. It is simply not true. Daniel would have laughed. You know, it says 10, it means 10. You think I'm making that up? You go buy the books and read them. I'm not making a thing up. Yes. Well, no, I think without getting into 144,000, I think he's talking about the church there, and it's as spiritual Israel. Of course, that's divisible by 12. And by the way, if you list the tribes, they're not the original tribes. You know, making it plain, it's not the right tribe to be fleshly Israel. We see it as not fleshly Israel. It's not the Jehovah's Witnesses. They won't be there at all. It is either upstairs or downstairs. It's a symbolic meaning, a large number. It's the church, and there's a lot of them. It's spiritual Israel. 144,000 means complete, you know, 12 times 12,000. It's the complete church, follow me? It's the complete spiritual Israel, and there's a lot of them. And they're all there. Well, you think about that, you know, but that's the kind of thing, without getting into specific, you know, without wanting to defend a specific interpretation, that's that kind of use of numbers. By the way, keep in mind, let's go on. Number 12, by the way, number D, letter D, underline the word often. Sometimes 10 means 10. It's like we use numbers sometimes exactly and sometimes not, but they tend to use them more symbolically. Number 12 often has symbolic significance. Exodus 28:21. And again, we won't take time to read all of these, which I list. And the stone shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names. They shall be like engravings of a seal, each according to his name, for the 12 tribes. The 12 tribes. By the way, how many tribes were there? Tribes were there? Well, this is, yes, you count Ephraim and Manasseh, but counting Joseph is one. Yeah, right. Right, but the tribe of Levi didn't receive one. Yeah, here's the 12. Really, count, depending if you give Joseph a double count, and of course the tribe, the Levites, did not get an inheritance. But you don't have 12 tribes exactly, by the way. But they were called the 12 tribes. Therefore, 12 is used with a symbolic significance, not exact. And by the way, you find the same thing in the Revelation 21 and 22. the symbolic presentation of the glorified, redeemed church as a cube, as a city, four square, not a literal city. And what are the foundations? The foundation of the 12 apostles, right? How many apostles were there? There weren't 12. You got that? So you have 12 tribes of Israel, 12 tribes scattered abroad. Were there 12 tribes? No. The church symbolically built upon the 12 apostles in the apocalyptic language of Revelation. Were there 12 apostles? No. At least 13. At least 13. Probably more. See how this fits? In other words, you get... you see that 12 has a symbolic significance. Leviticus 26:26. Now, understand what I'm saying about this, and I'm being very general. I don't have time to really study this subject, but it seems, while it may seem unusual to us to say 12 and you don't mean 12, it did not seem unusual to them at all. That's the one I had before, wasn't it? Let's see. Where am I? 24:5. I'm sorry, I looked at the wrong slot. Then you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes, 2/10 of an ephah, and each shall make a cake. By the way, there may be some connection between this number 12 taking on a symbolic significance to the fact that the ancient Sumerian number was based upon 6. For instance, indivisible by 6, you get a complete circle, and maybe some connection there. Well, anyway, that's speculation. Well, let's look at Revelation 7, 4 through 8. Let's look at both Old Testament and New Testament passages. And I hope sometime in the future, I know you don't have time now, but you'll get your notes out, maybe restudy this and look up all these that we didn't look up, and really do spend time that we don't have right now. Revelation 7, 4 through 8. Here's your 144,000, by the way, Jeannie. Number 12. I've already talked about that. Let's look at 21, 12 through 14. We haven't talked about that. Well, I have, really. It had a great high... By the way, I don't think he's talking about a literal city. First place, he tells us it isn't. In the prophetic way, he tells us it's a symbol by exaggerating and warping the dimensions that allow it to fall out of whack. It's a cube. This is the church glorified, but in symbolic language, symbolic city. Now, if you want to believe it's a real city, that's fine with me. You can be wrong. It doesn't make at least a bit of difference. However, I know that God doesn't like big cities, so it's probably, he likes countryside. I simply point out that he didn't create cities, he created. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, written the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, 3 on the west, and so forth. 12 foundations, which were the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Well, there weren't 12 tribes and there weren't 12 apostles. We already said this. Okay. The number, so it often has symbolic significance. Now we come to, and I think we ought to deal with it. I think Dr. Smith probably deals with this in some of his classes. Does he? The day, year theory. Have you already covered that? Would you let me skip that then? What kind of press for time? You all had Dr. Smith's class, haven't you? Nobody's missed that blessing. Listen, you get good stuff. You get the, you know, you get more meat and gristle. We give you the gristle in this school, right? Sometimes it's hard to chew. We give you the real stuff. Okay, I'm going to skip our discussion of the year-day theory, because he's already talked about this. The cults use it a lot, and it simply it won't hold up. I've given you a sufficient explanation that you can, I think, can follow it if you don't already know the issues. Let's come on down to prophetic symbols then. Prophetic symbols. With symbols and typology, we'll end principles and then get into history starting Monday, Lord willing, and the creek doesn't rise. Unless Monday falls on the 7th or the 12th. Anyway, prophetic symbols. First of all, First principle is this: interpret symbols by the same principles as ordinary figures, that is, based on resemblance or analogy. Oh, that's just a $3 way of saying, be careful, don't assume a symbolism that isn't there, or take a common sense approach to it, and see what it really means. I'll give you examples of symbols. Now let's look at Daniel 7. Of course, this is apocalyptic, an apocalyptic section. Daniel, the whole section in Daniel is these four animals which would make it real attraction at a zoo, the four beasts, and they are symbolic of what? Other than this class being a beast. Lion at the wings of an eagle, the lopsided bear, verse 5, the flying leopard, verse 6, and then the fourth beast, which goes beyond description in its horrendous, fierce nature. Right? Remember, how many of you took Daniel under me? Remember this? You have the lion, the lopsided bear, the flying leopard, and the Godzilla, or whatever, the fourth beast. Well, they are symbolic of what, by the way? Quickly. Yeah, for successive ancient Near Eastern kingdoms. Daniel 8, 5 through 7. The male goat coming from the west, not touching the ground, conspicuous horn. What was that symbolic of? What do you remember?
Alexander
the Great and the speed of his conquest. Revelation 12, 3. I'm trying to follow my practice of looking at both the Old and New Testament here. Revelation 12, 3. Remember we talked about yesterday? The same, it would symbolize the same kind of thing, but not necessarily the same thing. Seven heads and ten, we'll look at this in another connect. Seven heads and ten horns, on his head were seven diadems. Symbolic of what, do you think, by the way, just quickly? Seven heads, seven diadems, seven hills. Rome. Rome. And then Revelation 9, 7, back a little bit. The appearance of locusts was like horses prepared for battle, on their heads as it were crowns like gold, and their faces like the faces of men. Well, some of the very scary imagery of Revelation 9. Symbols. Let's move on. A prophetic symbol, we'll say here, must be examined with regard to the scope and context of the prophecy where it is used and by its analogy with other symbols. Now, again, we're not free. What we're saying is we're not free to simply arbitrarily attribute symbolic significance. We have to have a reason for it, other than our own wild, harum-scarum imaginations, or other than the last paperback book we just read. For instance, and here's some examples which sort of come out of the ancient Near East. Revelation 6, 2. Revelation 6, 2. I look and behold a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow. A bow. What symbolism would you have a bow? What's a bow? Yeah, as I indicate here, generally considered to be symbolic of power and conquest. The bow was the weapon of the invading army. First, you had a siege, so you'd use the bow. You couldn't use the chariots or the spears, the lances. You would use the bow. And so he had a bow in his hand, indicating conquest. Trees, by the way, are often symbolic of men. Ezekiel 31, in the Old Testament, 3 through 14. And you see, much of the symbolism in Revelation reflects the kind of symbols that we see in the Old Testament, sometimes the same ones. Son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude, whom are you like in your greatness? Behold, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon. And he goes on.
grew great, and the birds built nests. We see the same language, by the way, back in the book of Daniel. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar was pictured as a tree. He was cut down, and the band was put around the stump, so forth. Now, you find, look at Isaiah 6:13. Isaiah is talking about the war against Jerusalem. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it. It will again be subject to burning like a terebinth or an oak, that is, whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump. That is, Israel is like a tree, and the main part of the tree is going to be taken away, but there will be a remnant, like a stump. Without going into all the meaning, you see the imagery there, which is all we have time for. You can look at Zechariah 6:12, but let's turn now to Revelation 7:1. And here I think we have, he's talking about men. After this, this is an image now, a vision. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea or on any, what? Tree. A strange thing to say. Well, not mountains, or he's talking about men being withheld from men. Revelation 8:7. First sound, there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. This is the vision they saw, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. Well, the trees. I think he's talking about sort of in the general vision that doesn't mean exactly a third of the whole earth. I mean, in this image, it pictures significant wholesale death, destruction. Well, that's examples, and we don't have time to get into these texts. It's kind of tempting to try to get into these texts and develop them, but we just don't have time. Yes. Not necessarily. It's really tough. Sometimes they just contribute to the image. They're just a part of the picture. In other words, does the grass have some significance, you see? Probably not. It just contributes to the general picture. Maybe it means crops. But you see, but again, I doubt it has a specific meaning. Simply meaning this is what he saw, and the general picture was wholesale destruction of man, crops, earth, everything. Okay, colors and metals. We have about 5 minutes to go. I think we are going to finish this today. I'm glad of. Although no colors or metals have a fixed or arbitrary symbolic meaning, there are recurring themes in the prophetic and figurative language of Scripture. Now, turn to Revelation 6:1 through 8. We're already back there. Revelation. Remember the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I looked and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. That's Jesus, of course. And when he broke the second seal, I heard the second creature saying, "Come." And another, a red horse went out. And to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace on the earth, that men should slay one another. And a great sword was given to him. But the third seal, a black horse, with a pair of scales in his hand. By the way, the scales use judgment or sometimes famine. We had to weigh out the food. And the last of all, red, white horse, red horse, black horse, and finally verse 8, look and behold, after the fourth seal was broken, a pale horse or an ashen horse. And he who sat upon it had the name Death, and Hades followed with him. He was a ugly rascal. To kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. Now, white, and again, there is no fixed or arbitrary meaning, but white, some white generally means purity, joy, riches, sometimes a mixture of the three. You know, the redeemed in the book of Revelation had their robes washed white than any fuller could ever make them. Come down, let us reason together, saith the Lord.
though your sins be as scarlet, I shall make them what? Like wool. So you get this general kind of symbolism, but you can't, every time, doesn't mean every time you find the color white, the fields are white into harvest. Well, you know, there's no connection there. There the white means what? Like ripened grain, the light color of ripened grain. Perhaps some connection with the white robes of the white clothing of the Samaritans in that particular context, but anyway, it's not symbolic. Red, by the way, white, of course, white is sort of, it's self-suggestive, isn't it? We use this, by the way, don't we? The virgin bride wears what color? White, you see. Now, red, generally, this is very general, cruelty, punishment, or war. Why red? Why would red just sort of come to have that symbolic meaning sometimes? The color of blood. Well, your sins be as what? Scarlet. That means is bloody. And so the red horse takes peace from the earth. Cruelty, punishment, war, blood. Black. And by the way, this has been... this has been more or less preserved in our culture, many of these. The Red Cross. Black, the black horse, disaster, doom, and mourning. Yes?
Black horse is a ignorance.
Darkness, perhaps ignorance, maybe not the color black. Of course, by the way, black, blackness of night in the ancient world, you know, it really got dark at night. Black, outer darkness, blackness. Disaster when the lights go out all over the world. Disaster, doom, mourning. And of course, black has survived in our culture as the symbol of mourning. By the way, I understand in Japan that white is a symbol of mourning. Is that right, I remember? In China? It's an interesting reversal, isn't it? Why is it? But here, we wear black. You know, Johnny Cash makes a big thing about being the man in black. He's... Anyway. The black horse. General kind of symbolism, not always, yes.
Should black also be the opposite of true, like gold dressing?
No, it's interesting. black with sin? Not really, it's usually red with sin. You know, sins be as scarlet in the Bible. Scarlet? Scarlet, yeah, the scarlet letter. Right, remember Hester Prynne? The scarlet letter was red. Of course, scarlet. Pale. Pale or ashen, bleached out, blanched out, is symbolic of death. It certainly is in the on the fourth horse, isn't it? In fact, it says it's to kill with a sword, famine, pestilence. And of course, what in human experience would suggest paleness or the ashen, washed out look as symbolic of death? Yeah, you've seen a dead body. The blood drains away from the skin, and you say, we said that it pale as death. And so you have that. Now, of course, we all know that purple in the ancient world is a symbol for royalty. That's the Daniel 5:7. Daniel's promise he'll wear a purple robe if he interprets the king's dream. And we've already looked at Revelation 6:1-8. One more point, then we'll leave this. We'll stop for okay, take a break. Daniel 2, I'll not turn to that, 32-35. Here you have particular metals having a particular symbolism, but only in this text. Gold represents Babylon, silver, Medo-Persia, bronze, Greece, iron and iron mixed with clay, Rome. Doesn't mean every time you find iron in the Bible it means Rome, or gold it means Babylon. Now, I think there is some significance in the fact that you have descending orders of value. You know, it gets cheaper the farther down you go in the image. But here you have a particular image in which particular metals have a particular significance, which are explained in the text itself, by the way, pretty much explained. At least we know they're four. Even if you don't get the right kingdoms, they are four successive kingdoms, regardless of which ones they are. But that, again, is very local. You do not find a general kind of symbolism like that. Okay, we'll stop there. Come to the last thing I'm going to cover. There are some things, minor things we could cover, but time is getting away from us. The last thing in the principles of interpretations, we'll start Monday. I have a new material for you on history, and we'll make a quick survey of that. Biblical typology. Types and symbols. And I'm sure you've been introduced to this in other classes, so this will not take too long. Well, I'm sorry. We're not ready for that yet. We have one minor point under prophetic symbols. We have names, prophetic names. We can deal with this, okay? It is generally thought, I say generally, often thought by Bible scholars that Babylon became symbolic for Rome, that is a city antagonistic to God. A Babylon was any city antagonistic to God. Now, there isn't much evidence for this. There's some evidence. It's sort of it's an inference. Look at Revelation 17:5. He's talking about this woman clothed with purple, the great harlot who sits on many waters, the Roman Empire, with whom kings of the earth committed acts of immorality. Clothed in purple, is carried out by the Spirit of the wilderness. See the woman clothed in purple, adorned with gold and precious stones, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations. That's emperor worship, I think. Great blasphemy. And the unclean things of immorality on her forehead. By the way, there's another example. The writing on the forehead. I should have brought this up. I haven't thought about this. Remember, the mark of the beast has to be inscribed on the forehead. 666. Oh, I see. This is symbolic. On her forehead was written, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. This means she had the world's widest forehead. It continued over her left ear, down the nape of her neck, made a left turn, and back up. Pardon? Yeah. Revolving sweatband. Terrible. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations. If you meant Rome, why didn't you say Rome? Yeah. I have no trouble the way it was. Listen, he didn't say, as I understand it, he didn't say Rome for the same reason that the book of Revelation is written in symbolic language. For the same reason, it's an apocalyptic. The church is being accused of sedition, treason to Rome. There was just enough truth in it to make it dangerous. 1 Peter 5:13. This is a part of the postscript. To him who be dominion forever and ever, amen. And then he adds, following his end of this letter. Then he adds the postscript. P.S. Through Silvanus, our faithful brother, for so I regard him, I have written to you briefly, exhorting, as Silvanus carried the letter, probably, or at least wrote it. I exhort you briefly and testify, or exhort you, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it. She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark. Greet one another with a kiss of love, peace, to you, so forth. She at the church, she who is in Babylon, greets you. Where was Peter? Well, for one thing, now there are two thoughts of this. Some, I think he was not in Babylon. And just like the harlot, the great, the one that so vividly symbolized in the vision in Revelation 17 was not the city of Babylon, somebody tell me why. How can we be pretty sure that this city which is playing a major role in the book of Revelation is not literally Babylon? Yeah, Babylon was
was Babylon compared to Rome was like Bithlo compared to New York. Babylon was nothing. It was a garbage. It was an insignificant, out of the way village in the first century. Wasn't anything there. The idea of Babylon, the city itself, playing a major role in the events symbolized prophetically or symbolically described in the book of Revelation is absurd. And it is doubtful that Peter, the apostles, by the way, follow the general policy of working through and out of major metropolitan, major urban centers, as Paul did. There was Antioch and Ephesus. Paul spent, sort of springboard Antioch in the further to the west, Ephesus further east, Ephesus further to the west. It's very doubtful that Peter would be headquartering for a period of time in Babylon. Doubtful he would be there at all. So it's symbolic. It's not really Babylon, but symbolic of what? The majority of view is that it's Rome. As ancient Babylon was antagonistic to the city of God, so Rome is antagonistic to the city of God. And I think that's what it is. If Rome was a Babylon, everybody just call it Babylon. Some suggest that a minority view hold that it is Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was also opposed to the church. Where was the church first persecuted? In Jerusalem. And by the way, Lisa, you asked me about a book. Foy Wallace, I just get an alternate point of view, and he's a non-instrument scholar, Bible student, and a great scholar he is. He's written a very interesting book on Revelation, a lot of good material in it, but he takes position in Jerusalem. If my memory serves me, I think you'll find that. It's been several years since I've looked at the book, but that's Jerusalem, not Rome, which is the great enemy of the people of God. And there is something to be said for that view. I don't hold it myself. I don't think there's enough to be said for it. I don't think it holds up. But there is something to be said for it. So I would say that's a minority view I don't accept, but I think you ought to be aware of it. That it's symbolic of a city which is so antagonistic to the people of God. Okay? And then Isaiah 1, 9, and 10, and we're not going to take time to look that up, but here, if you go back and read it, you'll find, and it's not obscure, esoteric, it's not very hard to see, that Sodom and Gomorrah are symbolic of Jerusalem, and by the way, we still use this today. Sodomy is the old word for what? If somebody was a sodomite. Yeah, homosexual. And by the way, the wording in what few homosexual or anti-homosexual laws which are on the books in our country, that's the term, the legal term for it, sodomy, as I understand it. Just as a Babylon was a major city that was antagonistic to the people of God, whether it's the Old Testament people of God or New Testament people of God, what was a Sodom? Or a Sodom and Gomorrah. Yeah, in a moral city. That is great immorality, great the abandonment of even basic morality. And when Jerusalem was falling into its great sin, its idolatry, Isaiah calls it Sodom and Gomorrah. And the idea of ancient cities. Jesus said it would be more tolerable for what? Sodom and Gomorrah. They'll judge you. You're worse than they are. The cities of Galilee, major communities of Galilee, which rejected him. You're worse off than Sodom. That's not a symbolic use of it, but it's a point of comparison, pointing out that they were sort of synonyms for great immorality, great spiritual adultery, abandonment of God. And again, we use the same kind of thing. For instance,
even in our idiom. For instance, often if a city is really going the way if a city is becoming full of homosexuality, you would say, yeah, I've heard it, it's going to be another San Francisco, or it's going to be a San Francisco. And so that kind of creeps into our idiom. Okay, enough of that. That isn't too complicated. Come to biblical typology. Again, I think you've had this in other classes, should have had, some of it anyway. Have you not? We dealt with this some at least, so I kind of don't apologize for the brief treatment I'm going to give it. I'll give you my definition of it here. A type is an object that antedates another object. You might add it. You might add the word object or action. For instance, the action like the high priest walking into the Holy of Holies, the action itself was involved in the type, not just the blood, but the act of going in. We're going to see this. So I didn't put that in here. I do later on in my wording. So you might, just for the sake of completing, the type is an object or an action that antedates, what's antedate mean? Comes before, precedes, another object or action, which is designed, that is the first one, is designed, underline the word designed, to prefigure and with which it enjoys a like moral or religious principle. Then that's my definition. The further comment, a type is not necessarily a prophecy, and may not be recognized, that is from its, following the type which comes first, is not necessarily a prophecy, and may not be recognized as a type in its own age. Often they weren't. Often the connection is made after the fact. Now you see, not always, often the connection is made after the fact. We're going to see that, at least as far as we know. Remember, I said some prophecies are fulfilled in the sense that the Holy Spirit directs the New Testament writer to say that this is a striking parallel. So sometimes the prophecy moves from the past to the future. Sometimes the revelation stands in the future on the fulfillment and looks back to the past. And we've already talked about that connection with fulfilled prophecy. Same principle here. That is, sometimes, as far as we can tell, the type is established after the fact. Now you're going to see what I mean. We look at a couple of examples. Okay. Important distinctions. A, types are not accidental analogies. Whether they are objects or actions that intentionally refer to their antitypes. I'm going to break a rule of mine now, and I think you'll see why. To give an example, I make it a rule not to criticize chapel sermons, and I don't criticize the bad ones. This is too good an example to pass up. Brother John Pierce preached, and I thought it was a great sermon. I really enjoyed it. I think it was one of the better sermons we've had, and I really appreciated it. And it was well delivered. He's a good preacher, good delivery. You preached in some of his, you fellows know some of his techniques in communicating, how he used his voice, how he used gestures, used the very, his posture. And it's good content. I do think, though, I would like to ask him just one question. And I think I'm sure that there would be no disagreement between us. Remember he was talking about Stephen's sermon, and that he was quite accurately pointing out that Stephen was saying, just as our forefathers rejected Moses, you're rejecting Christ in the same spirit. And then he went on to say, he made the statement that, Moses left the palaces and condescended to save his people, and Jesus did this. And then he made the statement that therefore Moses is a type of Christ. Do you recall that? The type of Christ. Now, I don't agree. If you mean type in the same sense that the tabernacle is a type of the death and ascension of Christ that we're going to look at, explain the book of Hebrews. And I'm not criticizing what John said. It was an excellent sermon. I really appreciated it and told him so. And I think it's an example, though. Good example. I think he chose the wrong word, and I'm sure that if we sit down and talk about it, he would agree with me perfectly. In other words, I'm sure he used type in the sense of illustration. And it is. Interestingly enough, he's just about on solid ground with that, as we are in some of these doubtful types we talk about last. And I'll come to that in a minute. But what I'm saying is this. Let me ask you this.
Is there any indication from the preaching of Stephen that Moses was a type of Christ in the sense that... Let me ask it this way. Is there any indication, either in the accounts of Moses' life in Genesis, in Exodus, and... I'm sorry, in Exodus, and the... Or is there any indication in Stephen's sermon that there is an intended typology? Now, you might say, if I were going to defend that, what I'm saying, he may be right. I don't agree with that. I don't think it was a type. However, if I were going to argue the other way, you might say, well, a type is implied when it said, another prophet will arise likened unto me, and to him you shall hearken. But I think the word I would use, I agree with what he said, but the one exception, I would just take out the word type, and I would use the word analogy. I think you can draw an analogy because, from a legitimate analogy, because the prophet, in other words, if the Bible says, if Moses prophesied, another prophet is going to rise like unto me, unto him you shall hearken, that prophet, and we know it refers to Christ, then it's legitimate to say, okay, in what ways were Moses and Jesus analogous? Okay? And I think so. I agree with everything he said, except that one word type. I think what he meant was analogy, or type in the sense of analogy. And so the question I would raise is the question that, if you're talking about types now, the question is, can you find evidence in Stephen's sermon or in Exodus that there was an intended typological connection? I think not. You have to draw it by inference. However, we're going to look at these doubtful types I'm saying. We're going to see some of them are kind of shaky too. The question is, are these really types in that sense? I think the answer is going to be no, at least in my mind it isn't. Not a big important thing, but I'm emphasizing the word intended typology. Now, the reason I think this is important, Paul, I'm going to go past your question.
No, I'm just going to, what, isn't Moses a type of Christ in other areas of
Is it said that?
Did he mention also in the sermon about Christ being like a deliverer, like Moses was a deliverer?
Yes. I don't recall. Yes, he was. Yes, he did. Yes.
Okay, that would be
well, no, that would be an analogy. The question is, does the Bible make this typological connection? Now, type is a, what I'm saying is this, people. A type is a very specialized thing. And every time you find analogies that can be drawn by inference doesn't mean it's a type. A type, a pure type, is clearly stated as such. It's either before the fact or after the fact, usually after the fact. It's intended. And now the reason this is important, you say, well, what's the difference? As far as the meaning you get out of it, makes no difference. And as far as, you know, Brother John's sermon, no difference, whatever. And I'm not, you understand, I'm not criticizing the sermon. I'll just raise that question. And it gives us a good point to talk, you know, a good area to question, and maybe he's right, I don't know. The importance is this, you all, now listen to me, the importance is that false theologies are supported by false hermeneutics. And a common element of false hermeneutics is to find types everywhere. Remember, I found an elephant in the Bible. Remember that? That guy found types in the concordance, in the Bible maps, in the index, and in the box the Bible came in. And types everywhere. If you're not careful, it may sound like I'm being, you know, legalistic, and it may sound like Talmudic scrupulosity. never mind. You know what Talmudic scrupulosity is. Just think about it. Anyway, it may sound like that to really draw this distinction, but this is the very area where we get into trouble, because if we do not emphasize the word intentional or intended, talking about types, then we cast ourselves upon the sea of hermeneutical uncertainty. Amen? That is, if we are free to see types, listen to me, to see types where there is no indication that a type is intended, then we are free to arbitrarily attach typological significance to objects or actions in the Bible, are we not? If we sacrifice that principle, the word intended, then we are free, are you with me now? We are free to attach typological significance to any object or action, which is exactly what the allegorists did. This did get out of hand. We're going to see this in the history of it. And we are in trouble. By the way, many of the important doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church and many of the important liturgical aspects of Roman Catholic worship are supported by unfounded allegorism and by attributing typology to things in the scripture that have no typology. It's a very dangerous and important issue. Let me say this. If we are free, if we are not limited by hermeneutical principle and law, the science of hermeneutics, if we are free to see types anywhere and everywhere, if it seems to fit, we find a comparison, then the Bible can be made to say almost anything. And I support this by pointing out in the history of hermeneutics, and again, we're going to see this starting next week, this is exactly what has happened in the past. So, I am not simply being picayune. For instance, what I would say, for instance, if I were saying to Brother John, I would ask him, and I'm sure he would agree, that you do not open the door to that. If you're free to say that Moses was a type of Christ, in as the Bible uses the word tupos or type, then I think you've opened the door a crack, the door of hermeneutical principles. If you open it the rest of the way, you really got troubles. That's why I would question it. And I'm sure in substance he and I do not agree at all. And let me repeat again, I do not make it a policy to criticize chapel sermons. I like most of our chapel sermons. I like almost all of them. I always learn something from them, and I appreciated his more than most. Well, anyway, you get the point? So it is not a minor point. It's a key. It's why I underline it in your syllabus. Yes?
How about the specific now, like the brazen serpent being lifted up and Christ being lifted up on the cross? Is that any similarity?
It's a good question. The brazen serpent? It is, again, I think it's not a type. I think it's not that technical. I think it is an analogy or an illustration. But I think it's saying, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And there are many connections. But is it a type? Well, I would list that under doubtful types, the bottom, Dennis, in my opinion. It's a real question. The question is this. Now listen to me. The question is this. Did, when Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, was it intended from their point of view in the beginning to be a type, which didn't make a difference because they wouldn't know what the fulfillment was anyway. It's an academic question, but the question is that an analogy or a full blown type? I would be more comfortable with the word type. Well, I'm sorry, with the word analogy myself. And again, it's not very well. There, I think it's just no. I think it's an example. I use the word of Abraham offering Isaac as a type of what? A God offering his son? Ah, that's a good idea. I've heard this preached. As a matter of fact, I've preached it myself. I was wrong. When you start preaching, just count on this. If you're doing your job, in my opinion now, and it's not the Bible, but it ought to be. In my opinion, if you're growing the way you should be growing, you will throw away 9 sermons out of 10 immediately after you preach them, or at least within the next 6 months. You're growing. Did you ever preach a sermon, but when you preach it, you thought it was really hot stuff, and you go back a year and a half later, you dig it out, you come across it, and you say, you can't believe that you actually preached that thing. Did I preach that? Oh, you know, and that's healthy. And the sermons I preached my first 6 or 8 years in the ministry, I would not preach 1 out of 100 today. Doesn't mean they're all, you know, wrong, but just for all kinds of reasons. And this is one of them. I used to point to, I don't know if I used the word or not, I've preached before, but there was a kind of typological connection
Got that? A typological between the fact that Abraham offered his son, and God offered his son. Therefore, there's a connection. I just had a great time preaching on that. Is there any biblical justification for that? No. As a matter of fact, in the book of James, and in the book of Hebrews, and in the book of Romans, that is offered as an example of faith. It is offered and nothing else. There is no suggestion in the Bible, whatever that I know of a typological connection between the offering of Isaac and the offering of Christ. Understand what I'm saying? It is offered as an example of faith, that and nothing else. Therefore, I think sound hermeneutics will lead us to preach it as an example of faith and stop there. Now, I myself have offered that, and I think it just went too far. It doesn't mean that the conclusions that you draw are false, you see, or not helpful. It just means it's bad hermeneutics. It's a bad habit to get into, in my opinion.
It would be better when you preach the thing to say there's some similarities between you.
Yeah, it's one thing to offer something as an illustration or example. I've already said this. I'm glad you brought it up again. But it's something else to say, this is what the text means. This is the intended meaning of the text. See, it's one thing to say that there's a comparison to be made. But I'm making it. See, it's one thing for me to get up and say, I when I think of Abraham offering Isaac, I cannot help but think of God offering his son. And then I would, share some of the things I think of. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not the same thing as suggesting to you, to the people, that there is an intended typological connection between the two, which there is not, as I understand it. I've never seen it. That's a good question. You see what I'm saying? So I think we'll be very careful to label. And by the way, when you're preaching, I think you'll be very careful to label what is opinion and conclusion and just your own thinking, as opposed to this is from the Bible. Because what happens if you read a text, and then note this, here's what happens in the minds of the people. I'm off my subject now. If you read a text, you've read a text and you preach a sermon, your people, the people who hear you, will assume, and they have a right to assume, that what you say came from that text, that text that you are expanding. They have a right to assume, and they will assume, if it's a Bible school class or a sermon, they will assume that what you are saying, they will assume that what you are saying is an explanation of and expansion of what that text says. Will they not? Don't you? That's the fair assumption. Therefore, I think we have the moral responsibility, sound hermeneutic, just good, it's good for us, good for them, when we get into saying something, now that doesn't mean every word in the sermon, but saying something significant, when we know good and well that this is just our thinking on the subject, and it was in no way the intended meaning of our text. Got that? No way the intended meaning of our text. Then I think we have the responsibility to tell the people that in some way. Not to make a big thing of it. Just say something simple like this. Now of course our text, you can say something like this. Just honesty. See, now of course this is not what our text is talking about, but when I get into the subject, I think of, and then you can make some very valid, legitimate statements and helpful helpful material. But you have been honest with them, and you have taught the people something about studying the Bible. By the way, if you do this systematically, it will create a good, healthy, create a mentality and attitude toward the Scriptures in the part of your people, which is very healthy. By the way, your people can, if you preach in one church a long time, your preaching can very effectively train your people how to study the Bible for themselves. Whether or not you ever even bring up the subject, if they see week after week, here week after week, somebody who knows what they're doing handles the Scriptures legitimately, they'll pick up on that. And I think making little distinctions like this is honest, and it's instruction. You all see that? It does not mean you cannot say something in a sermon that is not in the intended meaning of your text, either by implication or an expansion or implication of it. It means you can, but if you do, I think you ought to tell the people that. And I'll say, you can do it without making a big thing of it. You don't have to really go into it.
An example of a genuine typology?
A genuine typology? Well, there aren't very many in the Scriptures. I list them here, but there aren't very many. Let me get to this. Let's go on. Types are not accidental analogies. Got that? Not accidental analogies. By the way, I think this Abraham offering Isaac and God offering his son, I think that's an accidental analogy. But it's not intended. Whether they are objects or actions that intentionally refer to their antitypes. Typology is not simply history repeating itself. Types are not precisely like the antitypes. That's simple, isn't it? They're different. Otherwise, they wouldn't be types and antitypes. It would be the same thing. And third, types are less exalted than their antitypes. If, for instance, Dennis, the serpent is a type, it's less exalted than Christ on the cross. A snake on a pole, a bronze snake on a pole, is less exalted. A high priest going in behind the curtain of the Holy of Holies is less exalted than Jesus himself going into the presence of God. And Melchizedek is certainly less exalted than Christ himself. The type is always less exalted than the antitype or the fulfillment of it. That's simple. Here's the principle. Before an object or action can be regarded as a type, clear evidence must exist that it is divinely intended to be typical. I already said that. Here are some examples. Hebrews 8:1. We have the one everybody thinks of the first, and I'm not going to read all these texts. You're familiar with this, are you not? The typology of the tabernacle and tabernacle worship. Now the main point in this is the main point of what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, and so forth. Minister of the sanctuary, the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. Hebrews 9:11-12. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle. See, the antitype is always more exalted than the type. Not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and so forth. And then the action, the offering of the sacrifice. And then verse 24, for Christ not enter the holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one. What's the word copy there? Is that tupas? Let me look at this. I should know that. Hebrews. Look at the word, Ed, in Hebrews 10:24. I'm sorry, 9:24. What do you find? Antitupos. That's the word. That's where we get our word type and antitype. Is a type of the true one. What's the true one? What's the word there? Is that aletheia? Okay. Now, so here you have clear examples. Melchizedek is a type of Christ. Hebrews 7:1-25. And we're not going to read this, but look at verse 15. And this is clear stuff. Another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a type of Christ in what way? That's very limited. What way was Melchizedek a type of Christ? Number one, what? What was his office? Priest. And number two, this is the only two areas I know of that really is a type. What was it? King. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. He was a king and a priest. What was the third one? Sorry. He was without genealogy. Not in the same way that Jesus was. He comes down to it. Here I think he's a type after the fact. That is, nobody knows. That is, he was not of the tribe of Levi, certainly. Too early for that. Well, where did he get his priesthood? We don't know. See, it says without genealogy, to the Jews, the office of priest, you had to be born to it. Right? Here you have a man who is a priest, but as far as we know, not born to it. And his place in history couldn't have been born to it. See, there was no Levites yet. It's back in the days of Abraham. Got that? So, what you have, although not in the same way, although not in the same sense, what you have is a man who's a king, a priest, and he is both without genealogy. And Jesus is king, priest, right? But, Jesus is our high priest. He is not of the tribe of Levi, is he? Of what tribe was Jesus? To his mother. Judah. Therefore, he was not born to it. Therefore, he is a priest and king without genealogy. That is, not by virtue of his genealogy, as was the rule.
the standard. You got that? So he's a type. And in that sense only, I think. Now we have these doubtful types, Hebrews 4:9, and I would include the bronze serpent in this, Dennis. I hadn't thought about that. That's a good citation. Hebrews 4:9. Here's a doubtful type. Question is, does the language of Scripture mean that you have a type like with Christ and Melchizedek? And I use the word doubtful. I don't know. Maybe it is. It doesn't make a big difference, but I think we ought to, if there's doubt, we ought to say there's doubt. Hebrews 4:9. There remains therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Of course, the Sabbatarians say it's Sunday. That's the... But what's he talking about? There remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Christian the Christian Sabbath? Thank you. Thank you, Bart. By the way, I think here he's talking about the glory, the redeemed. We still have a rest. Is the Sabbath a type of heaven? Therefore it remains a Sabbath. There was a Sabbath. It was a rest. God rested. The Jews rested. We shall rest. Is it? I would use the word doubtful. Yeah, I think it's maybe an analogy more than a type. It's sort of not a type in the same to the same with the same intensity that you have the tabernacle typifying the redemptive work of Christ, as explained in the book of Hebrews, is it? Not in that sense. Well, think about it. And again, 1 Corinthians 10, 1 and 2, which is very interesting. This would be very... Remember I said Brother John, he might, if I were going to defend the other position, that it was a type, I would use this as my defense. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud. We talk about this in another connection. All passed through the sea and were baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea and ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, which was Christ. Now, was the act of coming out of the Egypt through the sea, coming to the rock in Rephidim that Moses struck, finding life coming out of the rock, and we find life in the Rock of Ages, is that a type? Is that action, that series of events, a type of our conversion? In other words, in what sense was this? Well, the question is, and by the way, in both of these cases, in Hebrews and here Paul writing to the Corinthians, I use the word doubtful. Now, you see, the reason it's doubtful, in my opinion, is I understand this. You know, again, you make up your own mind. The reason it's doubtful is that we do not have explained to us what Paul had in mind when he wrote it. That he does not explain in what sense, or he does not explain what kind of connection there is. Is it simple illustration? Is it simple an analogy that we draw? Or is it a type? Depends on what he had in mind. And that makes no difference. I think, you know, we can... By the way, yes?
I'm curious about Elijah and John the Baptist.
Well, yes. Type in a sense. There's to be like him. A type, it's not really type and antitype. It is in a sense. Let me put it this way. And again, this is an area of doubt. I would say this, Paul, that Elijah was a type of John the Baptist in the same way that David was a type of Christ. And if you want to call that type, fine. Now, by the way, to answer your question, that's the only thing I know. Yes. That's why it's doubtful. That's why I say the word doubtful. In other words, here's what I'm saying. You might even apply the word doubtful to Melchizedek. I think that when temple worship was set up, it was designed so that it could be used as a vehicle for explaining the redemptive work of Christ. The blood, the atonement, the mercy seat. Got that? The high priest only going in. Why had the high priest only he go into this one place once a year? I think it's clear to me that they follow me. The action itself was designed to be a vehicle for teaching. Now, whether Melchizedek, his life was designed, let's come after the fact. See. And with Elijah, with David and Christ and Elijah and John the Baptist, it's prophecy. I'd say it's more of a prophecy than a type. A prophecy that one would come in the spirit of, with that word is used with John the Baptist, the spirit and power of Elijah, and Jesus came in the spirit of David, in many analogies. So I would be more comfortable with the idea that it's a prophecy, not a type. Well, yes, because Jesus said, those born of women, none greater than John the Baptist. Well, that's hyperbolic language, perhaps. But anyway, that's a good point. So you're into trouble. It's just not very clear in some cases. Let me say one more thing, and this is the last thing I'll say on principles. And I think it's appropriate. I didn't plan it this way. We end up with that word, the doubtful, the bottom line. I think you ought to realize, and just accept this now, that when you, those of you who are going to spend a significant part of your life and energies and brain power the next few years interpreting Scripture, which is most of you, perhaps all of you, you are going to have many question marks. Like many times you're going to deal with the text, and whether you're teaching it or simply studying it for your own benefit, you're going to say, apply, you follow me, when you've done your best work, brought all your guns to bear on the text, pull out all the stops and applied sound hermeneutics, many times you're going to simply say this: it may mean this, A, it may mean B, it may mean neither one. I think, and listen to me, I think you ought to right now get tuned in to the reality that that's going to happen and not feel like it's a sign of bad hermeneutics. The fact is, I'm not saying the Bible is understandable. There are many parts, many questions, you see, many things, most of them minor things, some of them more important things, which are simply, we do not have enough information available to us. And I think you ought to see this not as a sign of poor hermeneutics, but as a sign of good hermeneutics, and sometimes you'll even share this with your people. There's nothing wrong with getting up to the, you know, finally you're dealing with the text, and you get some element in the text. There's a couple of verses in your text, or something your text says. And you ought to say this to the people. I think you'll, it's honest, and I think it'll build confidence in your teaching and your preaching. Say, look, now this particular part of our text this morning or tonight, I have struggled with it, and I'm not sure. Some think it means this, some think it means this, and maybe it means none of them, and you make up your own mind. And you follow me? And just leave it there. That is inevitable. Doubt is sometimes, follow me, uncertainty is sometimes a sign of good hermeneutics. Sometimes it's a sign of ignorance. But listen to me, it's been my experience that the only teachers and preachers I've ever heard who had no doubts whatever about what the Bible said in general or what it said in particular were semi-literate hermeneutical nincompoops. I mean exactly that, and boy, the woods are full of them. In fact, if you listen to radio preachers, it's sort of a law, reverse law, that the less a man knows, the more certain he is of what the Bible says in every verse, every point. And if you want to be a real idiot, just assume, you know, well, that's what it says, and that's just, in other words, you know, that is unbroken certainty about what the Bible says, all the way through. Unbroken certainty is a sign of ignorance and bad hermeneutics. Good hermeneutics will create some doubts. Y'all understand what I'm saying? There'll be times and places. And by the way, this is a clear example, isn't it? Like the question of Dennis raised. Good question about, you know. Now, we don't have any. We can gain the full benefit of that text, but there are still some question marks. And I have many. You go to the book of Revelation. Listen, I got about as many question marks as there are verses in the book of Revelation. I think I have a general understanding. I hope I do of what it says. Boy, some real doubts, you see. And so this is a sign of, properly understood, this is a sign of healthy hermeneutics.